And welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Erin Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
Well, Bill, who gets free advertising of the week this week?
Well, I think we ought to go with Hilltop Springs.
Yes, you're reading my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hilltop Springs is a retirement community up on Hilltop Drive, number 7 Hilltop Drive, as a matter of fact. And they're kind of a brand new senior living facility, and they're great.
And they're great. We've walked their halls.
Many times.
They have those terrific little carts. Oh, yeah, thank you. My microphone was, had a mind of its own. It had a mind of its own, and it mostly wanted to float up. Super helpful. I wanted to hold on to it for 2 hours. No, I didn't, actually. So, yeah, Hilltop Springs, they have good food, too, by the way. So if someone invites you over for dinner, you should go. They have really good stuff. And the people are very, very nice.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get right on it.
Do it.
All right. You can find all of our archives and things, because I guarantee you we will replay this show. But the original show is today, September 17th, 2025, and we named it after the book, Varsity Blues, The Scandal Within the Scandal. The author is John Wilson, and he is our guest today. He grew up in Bowles Park Housing Projects in Hartford, Connecticut. I was in West Hartford. We were neighbors with his single mom and 3 half-siblings. Hand-picked tobacco from the ages of 12 to 16 to help his family scrape by. Education and hard work transformed John's life. He earned a bachelor's in chemical engineering and graduated from Harvard Business School with an MBA by the time he was 23. I think he did all right.
He wasn't messing around.
No, he wasn't fiddling around like the rest of us. Spent 5 years in college. He built a successful business career, rising from entry-level positions to leadership roles in multiple Fortune 500 companies. A global executive who has traveled to more than 95 countries, helping to lead companies to their full potential. At 29, he became the youngest partner in Bain & Company's history. As the chief financial officer, he helped Staples become the fastest company to reach Fortune 500. As the COO of Gap Incorporated, he led 80,000 associates to become the first specialty retailer to achieve a $50 billion market value. He also was the president of Staples International and a senior operating partner at McKinsey & Company. Currently lives in Cape Cod, one of my other favorite places, in Massachusetts with his wife Leslie, and they have 3 children. There's some other stuff too, but I won't read all of that. We'll get to that, I'm sure. So our guest is John Wilson, and we are going to let him drive the bus. Yeah. I don't know if they told you that, John, but there would be goofing off and bus driving.
Okay, that sounds fun.
Right? If you're going to spend a little time on a Sunday afternoon chatting about ostensibly what sounds like one of the worst chapters of your life, you know, you might as well have a good time doing it.
There you go.
Where do you want to begin with all of this? What a nightmare.
It has been. It's been a 7-year nightmare for my entire family. Probably the hardest part for my wife and myself has been to see our children suffer, you know, not at the hands of a schoolyard bully who was, you know, making false claims about them and spreading false rumors, but by federal prosecutors who should know better, who did know better, but abused our children to try to make a case against me in the court of public opinion as well as the court of law. And that's just below anything I've ever anticipated from our government.
So if you were going to give people like the elevator speech version of this, I realize that's got to be kind of difficult, but if you were going to do that, can you give them the, you know, 60,000-foot view and then we'll move down?
Sure. If people may recall, the Varsity Blues college admissions scandal happened about almost 7 years ago now, and it involved about 30 parents who were accused of cheating on tests, faking profiles for kids who didn't even play a sport, photoshopping, if you recall some of the famous photoshopping incidents, and bribing college officials to help get their unqualified kids in. And this included a lot of celebrities and well-off families. So Felicity Huffman, Lori Loughlin, those kinds of people. So it was a high-profile case, and the Boston prosecutors first uncovered the case from a random tip from somebody in Connecticut. And they soon pulled on that thread and found there were, you know, Hollywood celebrities involved and a lot of rich and famous people. So they said, aha, this could be a great career builder for us. There was only one problem for those Boston prosecutors. All the people in this case were in California. Rick Singer, who was the mastermind and the con man, confessed con man, behind this whole scandal, also was based in California. His company was in California. Two of the major schools were in California, USC, University of Southern California, and Stanford. And so by all rights, all of those families should have been charged in California. However, that wouldn't have worked for the careers of the Boston prosecutors. They needed some hook to bring all the trials and literally 300 people to fly back and forth between California and Boston. And it turns out that Singer, the mastermind here, had 3,000 parent clients, but only one was based in Massachusetts.
Oh, no.
Me.
Oh, no.
So they needed to charge me to give them venue in Boston. And so despite my facts being completely different from all the other parents, we didn't cheat on any tests. My kids were highly qualified. Our twin daughters got a perfect score in the ACT and a 99 percentile score.
Wow.
And my son was invited to play on the Olympic team, Olympic development program twice in high school. He played for Stanford Club and water polo for 6 years, won the National Junior Olympics 1 year, and played on the USC team. And we made donations to USC, and we got a receipt from the school for our donations. And they kept our money to this day. So we followed all the rules, did everything one would be expected to do. There were some inaccuracies in my son's profile. The Singer had changed my son's swim time by 6%, and his best time. And he had done some things to some awards that I wouldn't even know. Second string All-American versus first string versus third string is sophomore year, junior year, things like that. And that was the fraud, they said, was material. And they railroaded us through a trial that was outrageous. So they basically accused me to give them the venue hook. They falsely accused us. And then they piled on so many charges to try to force me to plead guilty. It was ridiculous. They piled on 9 felonies, 180 years of prison time, and all I did was make donations. I made donations to schools for kids who were highly qualified to give them a tiebreaker boost, and we didn't cheat on anything. We didn't put any false information into anything. Singer tweaked my son's swim times and some other awards, and that was the felony fraud that I was charged with, and it was just outrageous. They were able to do so many things we can talk through one at a time, but, you know, they did things like judge shopping on top of venue shopping. They picked their favorite judge, who happens to be the oldest federal judge in America, 87 years old, makes Joe Biden look young, and basically got that judge to approve all of their motions 98.3% of the time. So they blocked all our evidence. For example, my daughter's perfect ACT test score was not allowed into my trial. So it was inadmissible hearsay. We had certified results from
How can that be hearsay?
And that's what our lawyer said, and the judges said, take it up on appeal.
Were they accusing you of cheating for her?
No, they weren't accused of cheating, but they wouldn't let us bring it in. Oh. My son's certified swim time, the same thing. His high school coach in water polo wasn't allowed to bring in his own swim time because he hadn't witnessed it. It was a swim team swim time. That was the argument, and therefore was hearsay as well.
Oh,
and he was the high school water polo coach. This is the kind of stuff that happens. So they blocked our evidence 98.3% of the time. Didn't happen once or twice. It happened 660 times. So we lost at trial. I would have convicted me, too. We had no evidence of our innocence. They piled on 50 other defense witnesses who were all people who pled guilty. And so they basically said that we were, you know, guilty. And the judge gave jury instructions that said giving money to a school can be considered a bribe to the coach, even though it went to the school. This kind of stuff was going on.
That's not really a thing, though, is it?
No, it's not. And the appeals court said this is absurd. We had a group of law professors write what's called a support brief, an amicus brief, to the appeals court and said this would be the first and only time in history that the alleged victim of a bribe, in this case the universities, is the one who gets the money. How can the victim of the bribe get the money and give you a receipt for the money?
Yeah,
the receipt's awkward.
Yeah, the receipt. It says, I didn't even know you could give a receipt for a bribe. You know, it's crazy. The whole thing is just absurd,
they were new.
But that's the way the judge defined it. The judge defined it. So that's kind of the quick overview. We went to appeal.
Wow.
We also had 11 former U.S. attorneys basically write an amicus brief, another one that said John Wilson didn't get a fair trial. It's almost unheard of for the top U.S. attorneys across the country to criticize their former colleagues, right? Because they did that. And so I didn't get a fair trial because it was so outrageous what they did to me at the trial. And so we got everything overturned at the appeal except for one minor tax thing, which we're still working on trying to get that overturned. It was a tax mistake of $1,425. It's a felony, believe it or not.
Mm.
Even though I deducted the tax, the receipt I had on the wrong line in my tax return.
You must be
the wrong
bad
line.
Person.
And I overpaid my taxes. I overpaid my taxes that year by more than $100,000 because I put my wrong address. I was living in Massachusetts in Europe at the time, working in Europe, and I used my California. I don't read my tax returns. They're prepared by Goldman Sachs and Price Waterhouse. I just signed them through DocuSign. I didn't even read it. And so that was the kind of thing that they can get you for at the end, and we're still trying to appeal that because a $1,425 mistake on my tax return.
But do you get the $100,000 back?
What's that?
Do you get the overpayment back, at least?
I got the overpayment back down the road, after,
nice.
Years later, but, But it's just kind of crazy the kind of stuff they can do to you, right? So that's been the nightmare. And my poor children, the Internet, unfortunately, makes their wounds both deep and permanent. And so having the federal government say my son, they say to this day he's an alleged athlete.
Alleged.
My son had a world record. He had a world record in swimming. He was on the Oprah TV show when he was younger. And he was competing training for 750 hours a year, year-round, on three different club teams. Right? He was a real national and world-caliber athlete who played on the USC team. The whole thing is just absurd.
How old is he now?
Now he's 28. This happened 7 years ago. He was 21 when this happened.
Wow.
He finished his last year. So the whole story here, there's a lot more detail, was just a miscarriage of justice and an abuse of our criminal justice system where they weaponized it. In my case, they weaponized the justice system for personal gain, for career gain. They used me and treated us like collateral damage to get the media spotlights into Boston and to bring all the trials to Boston. And that's what they can do, and they have such power. And when they can cherry-pick their own judge, he approves everything they do. And then you have to go and lose at court and go to the appeal process. And this entire process cost my entire life savings. I grew up in poverty, as you mentioned up front. Literally, we lived on welfare as a kid. So I know the value of a dollar. I worked picking tobacco, as you mentioned, for $1.35 an hour in the sun, 40 hours a week. So I know the value of a dollar. This trial, over 6 years, including the appeal, cost over $11 million. Every penny I've ever saved in my life.
Wow.
Think about that. 11 million. They inundate you with motions and motions and documents. That's the documents in this case. They gave us 5 million documents, pages. Think about that. It cost me $350,000 just to scan all those documents so my lawyers could read them. But they didn't give it to you in a form you could read, right? So they give you 5 million documents because it included 50 people. And they just mix it all up, and they don't have it organized in a way that makes it easy.
Just like you see on TV, where they bring in, the pallets of files and stuff like that to bury them.
Exactly. So they can just bury you in legal fees, they can bury you in motions, and they kept piling on motion after motion. They didn't charge you 9 felonies up front. They charged you with one. And then every 2 or 3 months, they charged you with another one. They say, if you don't plead guilty, we're going to charge you with another one. And they did that and had 9 felonies and 180 years of prison. I finally said to my lawyers, look, they can charge me with killing Kennedy and say I was on the grassy knoll and accuse me of that. I said, I'm not going to plead guilty no matter how many charges. I said, tell them that. And they finally stopped charging me. I said, this is crazy. 180 years of prison time? I said, I'm not going to give up no matter what you say. I'm going to fight. And I've been a fighter my whole life, and I'll fight for my kids to my last breath and my last dollar. And that's really kind of the nutshell of the story. And there's a lot of gruesome and horrific things that they did that were literally beyond my imagination. I've always been a big believer in our criminal justice system in our country. And, my beliefs have been shaken to the core. I still believe most people working in the government are honest, hardworking people. I don't smear everybody. But there can be bad apples, like any large organization. And I unfortunately got some bad actors out of the Boston office who abused the system for their own careers and literally falsely charged me and then tried to railroad me through a process that has been an ongoing nightmare. In addition, we're also suing USC and Netflix.
Oh.
So we're having to fight three Goliaths. Fighting one Goliath, the federal government, is tough enough. But we're fighting three Goliaths because Netflix came out with a movie, they called it a documentary, about me before my trial even happened, and they poisoned the jury pool.
Oh, my gosh.
It's unbelievable, the movie they came out with and how they depicted me in that. So we're suing them, and we actually won.
Well, now after we talk to you, we'll all have to run and go see the documentary, and then we'll really know how bad they are.
Yeah.
John, we have to take a really quick break. I am so glad you are our hostage for both hours today, because there's a lot on this.
There's a lot to unpack here. Yeah.
Just at the outset, I just want to say, I thought it was only people in L.A. I had no idea it had anything to do with anyone on the East Coast or that it was being run out of Boston. So I wonder how many people just didn't ever connect all the dots. Wow. Our guest is John Wilson. He is the author of Varsity Blues, The Scandal Within the Scandal. So we'll be back with him in just 2 minutes. You can find everything about our show and the archive of this if you want to send it to somebody else at
wethepeopleradio.us.
I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
I guess if you ever turn your book into a musical, you can use that one. Oh, we have to turn John's sound back on. How would that be? There we go.
All right, I'm going to let him take over here.
Okay, John, are you in there?
I am here.
There you go.
So, John, your only recourse on this whole thing is just to sue everybody involved?
You can't sue the federal government, unfortunately.
Right.
So that they give themselves immunity, and that's frustrating, believe me, beyond what you can imagine. But we're doing several things. One, I've written a book, my wife and I, to try and get our story out there. And we do want to get the truth out there, and we're working to make sure as many people as possible can see and buy the book. And by the way, for your audience, none of the profits go to us. It's 100% all the proceeds going to charity, including a nonprofit that helps defend people who don't have the resources to fund their own defense.
What happened to us
has never happened to anyone.
Well, okay, so let's play this back to the beginning, and you're just regular guy with a regular job who doesn't have any resources and didn't accomplish all these things, and they come after you. How does that turn out? Are you in jail for 180 years?
Or whatever? Yeah, very much so. So the federal, here's another interesting statistic. The federal government has a success rate, a win rate, conviction rate of 99.6%.
Oops.
Think about that.
Wow.
It's terrifying.
Right? And it's terrifying. And it's not because 99.6% of all the people they charge are guilty. I don't believe that for a moment. But if you fit some purpose, and I believe many people are guilty, don't get me wrong. I don't think everybody's innocent. But, you know, there are some people who are innocent who can't afford to fight, including in our case. In our case, there were 50 people, including some, you know, lower-income people, some coaches, some test takers, some test administrators, some people who didn't have a lot of resources, and they're forced to plead guilty. Who can afford to spend millions of dollars defending yourselves against, you know, an army of lawyers? I think there are 20 government lawyers involved in this, right?
And did all of those people go to jail?
In our case, I think everybody went to jail for either a couple of weeks or a couple of months or 4 months. It was absurd. These people cheated on tests. Yeah, that's wrong. We didn't do any of that, believe me. But is cheating on a test now a federal felony? So that's what they charged me with, cheating on a test. They made it a federal felony. Some people put together fake photos of their kids.
Why? What would a fake photo do?
For the athletic program. So Singer's business model, so he did a lot of legitimate work. So Singer had 3,000 clients, including people like Steve Jobs and John Doerr, very famous people.
To get their kids into college. He was like a consultant guy.
Get their kids into college, right.
Yeah, okay.
He was a college consultant. So Singer was a college consultant who worked with a number of parents, 3,000 parents, and he was helping give them real legitimate services. And for example, in our case, he had tutors. He had a whole fleet of tutors, kids who were in their 20s who went to, top schools, who would help tutor your kids in high school on how to prepare for the ACT or the SAT test, things like that. He had a bunch of legitimate charity work. So we would do some weekend work. I would drive my son from San Francisco, where we lived at the time, to Sacramento to do some charity work, volunteer work, helping tutor inner-city kids in Sacramento. So he had a lot of community service things he did. And he knew everything about most high schools and colleges. I was surprised at how encyclopedic his knowledge was. And my son played water polo for 6 years, and so it's an unusual sport. But we knew all the top schools in the country and all the top teams, because every year we go to the national tournaments for water polo. So we knew all the schools, and he knew them too. So I was surprised. I was impressed. So Singer had this business that he developed over the years, and the way he got his client base was by getting references from highly respected financial institutions, in part. So, for example, Goldman Sachs. He worked with Goldman Sachs, and Goldman Sachs, my representative, who I knew for 10 years, called me up and said, hey, now your son's entering high school when he was a freshman. There's this great resource we have, a guy named Rick Singer, who has worked with a number of our clients and a number of our employees, and, you should take a call. I took a call. When Goldman Sachs recommends someone, you assume they're vetted, and I talked to Singer. I met with him. My family, my son met with him, and he seemed like he knew what he was doing. He didn't know what he was doing. We trusted him. He came from Goldman Sachs, and he knew everything about water polo, knew everything about the colleges, knew everything about high schools. He had real charity work. He had real tutors. So my son was taking like weekly and monthly, tutoring sessions over the internet for an hour or two, helping to practice on, SATs and ACTs, that kind of stuff. So, and we were doing weekend work, tutoring inner city kids. So it was the real deal. We had no reason to distrust him. And when he has people like, Steve Jobs as clients and stuff, you say, he's the real deal. So that's how Singer kind of infiltrated into families. And then he was coming over to your house once a month or so to meet with you and meet with your child. And that's the way he ran his business. He would come to the house, once a month, stop by for an hour, meet with you and our son together. Then he'd meet with my son separately for about 10 minutes. And then he'd meet with us separately at the end to talk about what are the next steps.
And your son's and at what point in school is he? Sophomore, junior?
He was a freshman in high school.
Freshman. Okay.
Right. Wow. He started as a freshman in high school, and we started working with him for years. Well, we worked with Singer for 10 years.
Yeah.
And we had no reason to distrust him. Right? He was doing legitimate things for us, and he had, as I said, thousands of clients. And that was when I was living in California. Then my job took me to Europe. And I moved the whole family to Europe, except for my son. My son was then a junior and senior in high school. He wanted to stay to finish his high school. I don't blame him. And if he went to Europe, my daughters and my wife moved to Europe. At school in Europe, he'd have to repeat a year because they have a different system there, the international baccalaureate system. So he said, I don't want to repeat a year of high school.
Yeah.
And I want to finish. So we let him stay with very close family friends. And Singer said, fine, I'll continue to help tutor him, and I'll help him prepare his college applications. And I was living nine time zones away from California, out in Europe. We were living in Amsterdam for my job. And so it was hard to communicate with nine time zones difference. And so Singer said, I'll make sure his applications are complete. There's nothing missing. I'll make sure that they're all submitted on time. And so we talked by phone and by email occasionally to see how things are going. And so that's how Singer got involved in my son's college application. And I never thought there'd be anything fraudulent, in the materials that he submitted. And,
well, he didn't need to cheat. Right.
He didn't even need to cheat.
So why would somebody do that?
Well, exactly. Why would you even think he's doing that? And he changed the swim time by 6% over his best time. Like, why would you do that? Who cares about 6%? It's like, really? I wouldn't have even known my son's swim time to that level because I didn't pay attention to his swimming. After like his, let's say seventh grade, he shifted over to water polo full time and only did swimming in the swimming season to stay in shape. So, swimming wasn't really his thing. He liked, competing with a team and all that stuff in water polo. So I always went to water polo matches. I didn't go to swim meets very much, maybe once in a while. because swimming wasn't his preferred sport after he got into water polo. So I wouldn't have even known the swim time. I didn't know swim time within 6%. And every year they change so much as he grows, right? He's
sure.
a freshman, he's a sophomore. He grows 3 inches and he gets, 5% faster just because his arm length is longer. So
well, and you had three kids. It's not like you weren't like a stage mom, sitting by the pool.
I'm working, and so I'm busy. I'm working, and I wouldn't know his swim time. Frankly, within 10 or 20%. And so it was the kind of thing that I was shocked that I was even arrested. I got to tell you how this thing started would probably shock your audience too. And it's worth spending a minute or two.
Sure.
So I lived my whole life working hard. I've worked hard. I was successful. I pulled myself up my own bootstraps and was self-made. And I've never been arrested. Never been charged with a crime in my life, right? I follow the rules as best I can and try to earn for my family. And I provided a good life, and I was living the American dream. I was flying from Europe to a client meeting in Houston, Texas, and this is in March of 2019. I get off the airplane, go through immigration and customs. My passport is flagged. There's a problem. They bring me to the back room. In the back room, two FBI agents push me against the wall, tell me I'm under arrest. For honest services fraud. They handcuffed me.
For what?
For honest services fraud, they say.
Okay.
I said, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And you'll be shocked by their answer. I said, we don't know. We've never heard of it before.
Okay.
I said,
oh my
how
gosh.
Can you be arrested for something? You don't even know what it is. You've never heard. Yeah, it's a really unusual charge. It's some kind of fraud is all we know, but that's all we know. I said, what? How can you be arrested for something you don't know? You can't even tell me what I'm under arrest for. Right? It gets much worse. So they proceed then to handcuff me, put me in the car, drive me from the airport. I'm being perp walked, and then go to their facility where they have a booking station. And they do all the normal intake stuff of fingerprints. They give me my call. My wife was in Europe, so I didn't call her. It was too late. And so I called my secretary because I'm in Texas now versus European time zone. And so call her, make my call, please call my wife tomorrow, or my brother, who was a civil attorney, and so forth. And once they figure out how to book me, then they transport me to a federal prison. So they bring me to a federal prison, not a jail, an 850-person prison in Houston. They drop me off and hand me off to these prison guards. The prison guards then shackle my ankles in addition to my handcuffs, so I'm shuffling through the prison. Then they process me there. They strip me down and put me in this large multi-person shower room, and they get a couple of hoses and start hosing me off, power hosing me off like an animal.
Wow.
I still have no understanding of what I'm under arrest for, right? So now I'm being hosed down and have no idea, naked, and then they finally, after they finish hosing me off, they give me a jumpsuit, a brown jumpsuit or tan colored jumpsuit, and I'm still talking and saying, I have no idea why I'm here, and they don't believe me. And they're kind of like saying, shut up, don't talk, look straight ahead. All these, they're barking out orders at me. And I say, I have no idea why I'm here. And they're just like in disbelief. One guard finally, before he puts me into the cell block, my cell block had about 85 people in it. It's like you see in the movies. Two stories, a big common area in the middle, but lots of prisoners mulling around. And one of the guards must have felt sorry for me because I'm just talking up a storm, which is unusual. I'm saying, can someone tell me why I'm here? And he says, hey, look, watch your back in there, his son. He called me son. Watch your back in there, son. He says, you're the only old white guy in the cell block.
Oh, terrific.
And they're all going to assume you're a pedophile. And they hate pedophiles in here.
Oops.
And some of them may try to stab you with a shiv. So watch your back. I said, what?
What?
Can you lock me in my cell? I said, can you just lock me in my cell so I can, at least avoid being stabbed? He says, no, you can't. Lockdown's not until whatever, 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And I said, well, can I stay in my cell? You can stay in there, but then they're going to think you're a real, P-U-S-S-Y. I said, what?
Yeah,
that's not going to end well for you. They said, if you hide in your cell, it's not going to end well. They're going to know you're like a wimp, and they're going to come after you there in your cell. I said, well, geez, what do I do? So just walk around and don't accept any favors from anyone and just watch your back. So now I spent the next 2 days in this prison cell block. Watching my back, every time someone came near me, you think that someone's going to stab me.
Sure.
And it was the craziest experience. I still had no idea what I was even there for. And I remember
what about the whole phone call and that kind of thing?
I made a phone call to my secretary and just told her to call my brother, right? But that's it. I didn't have any information of what was happening to me. All I could do is make one call out. She had no idea. My wife was in Europe, so she was. It was too late to wake her up. And so I just called my secretary and said, please have my brother. My brother would come the next day. But that whole day and night, I had no other contact with anyone. I had no idea what I was under arrest for. I'm in the cell block, and every time someone comes near me, and people approach me doing all kinds of weird things. They want to get some slippers, some bigger slippers. You want to get some food, just trying to offer me things so I would owe them, right? I said, no, I'm not. No, thank you. I kept walking away.
Yeah.
Thinking, and I never, I'll remember this, too, for the rest of my life. I never felt better when I was finally locked in my cell block. I only had one guy in my cell block with me, my bunk mate. And I was bigger than that guy. So I said, look, I'm taking the bottom bunk. Made him take the top bunk so I couldn't get stabbed from underneath. And so I felt a relief being locked in a prison cell. I remember that. It's like, this is crazy. I feel relieved I'm locked in a prison
cell. Sad it wasn't
because
smaller.
Because the other 80 guys can't stab me from the general population.
What prison is this? Not that it matters, but where is
it? It was in Houston. It was the Houston Federal Detention Center, whatever. I don't know what it's called, but yeah.
Okay.
It was just crazy.
How old are you? How old were you when this happened?
I was 59.
Wow! So you're like a grown-up who's now. Bill's shaking his head here.
This is how they started. It was just day one, and the next day they did even worse stuff. Right? This is how they can intimidate you. So the next day, I get pulled out, and they say you have a visitor here, and so they put me in shackles again and handcuffs, and they shuffle me down some hallway to some meeting room in the prison. Where my brother is there, thank God, and he had another lawyer, he had a criminal lawyer with him from Houston, from Texas, and they're behind this plexiglass wall. I couldn't even meet with them. I could just talk to them through this plexiglass wall or whatever it was. And so I'm handcuffed and shackled, and I'm talking to them through this wall. And I said, what's going on here? And they said, there's something about Rick Singer. I said, what? He said, yeah, there's like 50 people all under arrest for cheating and bribing and faking and all the stuff on, you know, profiles in colleges. I said, I didn't do any of that. What's going on? It must be a case of mistaken identity. That's what I told the FBI at first, too. I said, there's 15,000 John Wilsons in America. There literally are.
Wow.
I said, you must have the wrong John Wilson. And they say, no. What's your address? I live in Massachusetts. Oh, you're the Massachusetts guy. They said, yep, we need, yep, you're the right guy. And so that's how this whole thing started. I went to the judge to have a hearing on bail. And then I'll never forget, the Boston prosecutors were on the phone. They weren't there. They were in Boston. They were going to make their big announcements that day in front of the media with all the other people in Boston. I'm in Houston. They're on the phone, and they tell the judge had some kind of bail bonds person or bail person, whatever they're called, talk to me about, you know, my history of not being arrested before, never being charged, living with having a wife for 30 years and children and a job and those kinds of things. And they said, look, you're not a flight risk. You're not a risk to society. You're not going to go out there, and maybe you're a serial donor, but that's not going to hurt anybody.
Serial donor.
You know, so they said, okay, they recommended being released on a bond. And then the Boston prosecutors on the phone said, no, we object. We want $1 million, all cash, that Ms. Wilson had put up. And the judge said, what? That's absurd. Never heard of that. All cash. Just a bond should be fine. They said, no, we object. Throw him back in prison. We're going to appeal your decision. So they threw me back in prison again while they're appealing her decision. She said, look, I'll let you appeal my decision, but I'm going to only give you until the end of the day to come up with new evidence as to why Mr. Wilson is such a flight risk or risk to society that he has to have $1 million of all cash bail. So then they brought me back into prison with my buddies, and then they took me back out at the end of the day, and they said they had no new evidence. The judge said, well, I didn't think you would. They just threw me back in to be spiteful. And then she said, I'm going to release him on a bond. I signed some kind of bond statement, and I was able to leave, you know, the next day.
Hmm.
But that's how they play. They
and
can
what
play
was,
that role.
What was the bond?
I think the bond ended up being like $100,000 or $200,000. I don't even know what it was. Like $200, but I just had to sign a paper for it.
I bet
it was
these,
like, a cognizant bond.
Like all these, you know, illegal alien guys that have committed all these murders and rapes and stuff like that, that are all just being, you know, moved through the system and then cut loose. I can't imagine after going through that doesn't just light your hair on fire.
Oh, it's crazy.
If you haven't pulled it all out by now.
How different, how they, you know, they say no one's above the law. They just kept sticking to me at every step in this process. And that was just day one. It gets much worse. My story. The high pressure tactics they can do.
Hold that thought, and we'll go to the next phase of the game. So for all of you who thought you knew what was going on with the varsity blues college thing. College admission scandal. That's what they called it, right? Wasn't that the big headline?
It Operation Varsity Blues.
Oh, my God. This truly is the scandal within the scandal. Our guest is John Wilson. You can find all the information about this and the archive of the interview here later this afternoon at
wethepeopleradio.us.
I can't get these memories out of my mind. And some kind of madness has started to evolve. I tried so hard to let you go, but some kind of madness is swallowing me whole. Yeah.
Watch out. You might get what you're after. Cool babies. Strange but not a stranger. I'm an ocean Africa. Burning down the house.
Okay, so they burned down your house, pretty much. Put you in the cell, and so we were, Bill and I were talking in the break. Did they do this to everybody? Did they just, like, snatch them off the street and throw them in prison and scare them like that?
No, I was the only one that had that experience. They did arrest people with some pretty harsh tactics in their homes. They came up to people with guns drawn and things in people's homes, and, you know, it's just kind of crazy intimidation.
But they didn't drag them away and, like, you know, talk to them about shivs and stuff
that? They didn't put me, that was the only one who got put into a federal prison for a couple of days. I think they did that to intimidate me because they knew that I had the best facts. They knew I was innocent, and they wanted me to plead guilty no matter what because that would avoid them, you know, having an embarrassment at trial. And when my facts came to light, you know, if they ever came to light and the judge blocked them, they would be embarrassed and say, wait a minute, why are 300 people flying back and forth between California and Boston for this trial instead of one guy going to California?
Yeah, why didn't they just prosecute the people in California? Like, why did they need somebody where you were?
They wanted the case here for their career.
Okay.
The Boston prosecutors wanted the media spotlight that could boost their careers. And I understand that the temptation there. If you're a prosecutor, you make $100,000 to $150,000 a year as a lawyer, which is, you know, a good salary. But if you get a high-profile case like this, this could make your career, and you can get $1 million job, a partner role, at a major national law firm. And so this kind of, you know, opportunity is a ticket, you know, to the top. And so it's very tempting for them to go after these high-profile cases and do whatever they can to make sure they keep them. And that's what they did. They used me as the kind of the venue hook, and it didn't matter if I was innocent. I was just collateral damage to their career aspirations.
Mm. Dang.
So how many people were scooped up on this thing altogether?
50 total. I think there were 52. Roughly 52.
All right.
I think there were 32 parents and 20 others that included, like, Rick Singer, the center, some of his people that work with Rick Singer. There was a couple guys who took tests. There were these guys he had. I didn't know these people.
Yeah. But
they had some guys who were doing test taking for people who could get any score you wanted. They were that smart. And he had some coaches that he was paying, and he had some other people he was bribing. So he did have a bunch of bad actors, but that was only 1% of his client base. Think about that. He had 3,000 parents. Only 32 were charged. So Singer had what his colleague said in an interview with the USA Today. He had wholesome accounts and dark side accounts. And the wholesome accounts never knew about the dark side. So only 1% of Singer's accounts were doing, I'll call it, dark side activities. They were cheating or bribing or doing things. The other 99% were like me. They were innocent.
Right. And of the of the ones that were charged, were they all convicted?
Everyone but one who actually went to trial with me. He was convicted as well. Only two people went to trial. The others pled guilty. I think the others pled guilty. I don't know their facts, but I saw some of their facts. A lot of them had done bad acts. They were cheating on tests. They're talking on the phone about cheating on tests and things. So they all pled guilty except one. That other person ran through the same crazy, unfair trial as I did. He got convicted and everything. And then upon appeal, got everything reversed, all the core charges as well. So that was the only other person. Mm-hmm. But those people were doing bad acts, right? And again, at its core, this is about, you know, wealth and privilege. You know, people who are wealthy abusing their privilege, right?
Right.
And getting unqualified kids in. And that's wrong. I don't condone that at all. But again, our case was totally different. You know, my son played for the USC team, and he played at the national level. My daughters, as I mentioned, had a perfect and a 99 percentile score. Think about a perfect score in the ACT, just to put it in perspective.
Yeah.
Less than 5,000 kids out of 1.8 million get a perfect score, right? So they were extremely talented. That's above, that's the top quartile for Harvard and Stanford, right?
Mm-hmm.
These were not like sloughs and lackeys. These are kids who are highly qualified, and there's no need to bump a more qualified kid. I think one of the big public narratives here is you had these rich people getting kids who are stupid, supposedly, accepted into college and bumping my poor child who's very gifted and talented. I can see the average person saying that. And so it's unfair that this rich person's bumping my more talented daughter or son. In our case, it's hard to get more perfect than a perfect score or a better score. And so there was no need for us to bump anybody. And what Singer told us all along is that, hey, in these top schools, there's 20 qualified applicants for every spot. So your odds of getting here are only 5%.
Mm.
If you make a donation, you can improve those odds to 50% or 25%. And you can do that, and you can either be, if you're a D1 athlete, you can be a walk-on candidate, or if you're not an athlete, you can be a team manager, and you make a donation to these schools, and they'll give you a team manager role for your kid, and they'll give you a tiebreaker boost. Your kid has to be qualified, and we never cheated on anything. If your kid's qualified and there's 20 spots, it can be a tiebreaker boost if you donate $100,000 or $200,000 or whatever the number is for the school.
Hmm.
So now,
but that's what we did.
Is your son the oldest of the three kids?
Yes, he's the oldest. He was a finished up his last year at USC when this happened.
That's what I was going to
ask. It was just horrific for him. It was just horrific for him. And he graduated eventually, and he got a nice degree in economics. He had a 3.0 in his economics major. So he's clearly qualified, right? And USC doesn't have great inflation, so he did, you know, did well there. And he played on the team his freshman year. And after that, he got his fourth concussion. Water polo can be a brutal sport. People throw elbows and knees a lot.
Sure.
So he got hit in the head again. And so it was his fourth concussion. And they'd have these processing speed and all these other protocols. And so in high school, he had several concussions. And, you know, he said, why am I going to keep doing this? I don't risk my brain. My brain's too important, he said. And so he resigned after this. He went through the entire season and postseason and trained with the team and everything else. But after the season was over, he said, look, I'm not going to keep doing this. I want to risk my brain. My brain's my future. So fine. But that was it. And that's all. You quit after the first season.
He was good enough to be on the team, qualified to be on the team. So why would...
He was one of the fastest on the team. He was literally one of the fastest on the team. So the irony here is they said, oh, you exaggerated the swim time. Singer did exaggerate the swim time, but his actual certified swim time was still one of the fastest on the team. The judge wouldn't let us bring that into the trial, which is crazy. But he was one of the fastest, and his high school coach recommended him to the team. My son played for one of the top 20 high school coaches in the country. This guy, Jack Bowen, he has more wins than anybody. He has 500 wins in water polo, coaching high school. He has coached, I think, something like 55 kids who've gone to play in D1 and other colleges over his 20-year career. He was a twice NCAA MVP water polo player when he played for, I think, Stanford. And he was an Olympic team goalie. So this guy was the real deal, his coach. His coach trained my son through middle school and high school and called USC to recommend my son. And he testified at my trial that he recommended my son to the school. And the government said, it doesn't matter if your son's the best at the trial. He said, if he's the Tom Brady of water polo, if there's one false statement in this, you know, one-page profile, that's fraud.
Oh, my God.
My son's swim time by 6%, really? That's it? But no one could even know how much was off because the judge wouldn't let us bring in the real swim time.
So when
best times, right?
So this all started, so the consultant was hired when your son was a freshman, and
right.
Then he gets accepted, obviously, goes to USC,
plays on the team.
After his senior year, everybody's going along fat, dumb, and happy, like just living their lives. And then when does all this, when do you suddenly become acquainted with Bubba in the cell?
2015, 14. Right, and then all of a sudden it's 2019. So what happened in 2019, we're talking to Singer about my daughters. My daughters just starting to enter high school. They were freshmen in 2019, and so Singer's talking to us about helping them with coaching and tutoring. And so my daughters are, you know, doing extremely well. They're getting, like, perfect scores on some of their tutoring. So Singer's talking to me on the phone about, you know, making donations again. He called it the side door. Singer said there are three ways to get into colleges. There's the front door, which everybody uses. There's something called the back door. These are not, like, nefarious. He said they're all, and there's literally emails from Singer saying this, that the front door, back door, and side door are all legitimate. It just depends on how much money you donate and what benefit you get. If you donate, you know, millions of dollars to fund a building or something, or naming rights for a building, you get what he called lifetime VIP status. You become a big name to the campus, and you can help get your entire family for generations sometimes into the school. You know, you donate a building, and all of a sudden now there's, you know, pull within the university to get your grandchildren in and your nieces and nephews in if you want.
And that's all legal.
Called the back door. It's all legal, the back door.
Yeah.
He said the side door is just a one-time VIP. You make a smaller donation, $100,000 up to $1 million, depending on the school, and you get one child only, a special boost for one child. And it's usually with the sports team, he said. You can do it with other programs, but sports teams, and they'll have walk-on spots if your child's a really good athlete, or they can be a team manager if they're not an athlete on those teams. But you make a donation of $100,000 or $250,000, something like that, and you get a one-time VIP status. That's how I described it, the back door, side door, and front. So I said, okay, great. I had already donated, you know, I don't say this in my book, I say it, but I don't say this to brag, but I'd already donated a couple $1 million over my lifetime. I've been very successful. I believe in giving back. I even funded all of my nieces and nephews' college, right? So I did this in 1998, I put $100,000 to fund my five nieces and nephews into a trust of my brother. It was not allowed into my trial, but we had it. And that was enough to pay for all five of their college. Back then, $20,000 could pay for college, believe it or not, you know, 28 years ago or something.
It's okay. We're old. We remember that.
Yeah, but I was basically, yeah. I believed in college. College changed my life. I went from picking tobacco to being a professional at, you know, Exxon and then moving on to an MBA. And so I believed in the power of education.
Sure.
I'd always given. And in my will, and this is something they also blocked for my trial. They wouldn't let my written will in. In my will, I was giving $5 million to Harvard, where we were applying with my daughters, and to RPI, where I went to school, right? And in that will, it said explicitly that would be all for scholarships for kids whose parents didn't go to college, like mine. I had a single mom who had an eighth-grade education, and my dad, who adopted me, my stepdad later on, he had a 12th-grade education. That's it. He was a sergeant in the Air Force. So I know the power of education. And I was leaving millions of dollars. I was highly successful. I was leaving millions of dollars in my will to fund this. Singer knew that, and the government knew that. And so they tried to take advantage of me. They said, look, why don't you donate a piece of that now? And this is in 2019 when they're recording these calls. Give a piece of that to Harvard and Stanford, and you're just going to move up what's already in your will, and it'll help your daughter's admissions chances. I said, okay, fine. So I gave them each $500,000 to Singer's Foundation in 2019. It went to his foundation, which I also verified with Goldman Sachs, with the IRS, was in good standing. And the IRS website said, you can rely on this confirmation that your donations can be tax deductible. Then they tell me, so here's one side of the government, the IRS, with their official website for Singer's Foundation called the Key Worldwide Foundation, is verifying and certifying that it's in good standing and you can deduct your donation. And then when I made it, they said, we can't deduct that. That's all a tax fraud. So wait a minute, trust the IRS website. Wow. So this is kind of something they can do. So they set me up, and with all these other parents, just in these recorded phone calls, how they can separate things and make you sound bad, is they had people talking about cheating on tests. They had parents literally using the word bribe and bribing coaches, bringing cash to coaches and so forth. The only thing that Singer said to me that was incriminating a couple of weeks were, are you okay if I give a check to the sailing coach at Stanford? I say, sure. You know, to me, it was a check, just like we gave a check to USC. You gave a check, it was made out to the school. You have to give the check to somebody. You don't just throw the check in the pool. You give the check to somebody. You give it to the person who's the coach, and he gives it to the foundation at school. And it was made out to the USC Foundation, for example. It was made out to USC water polo. It was one water polo. It was the USC Athletic Fund, the Trojan Athletic Fund. It was called. So man, it's a Trojan. So you give a check to them. So on the phone calls, he says, "Are you okay if I give a check to the coach?" I say, "Sure." And then when the jury hears 30 other parents talking about bribing, 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 and then you hear my phone call and he says, "Are you okay giving a check to the coach?" Well, it sounds like my check to the coach is a bribe. But it wasn't. My case is totally different than their cases, right? And so that's how they can blur things and make you sound guilty. But I never said I'm going to bribe someone. I just said I'm
going
to check
the coach. John, hang on. We've got a lot more to cover here, but we have to take a little break for the news.
Sure.
So we'll put a little Johnny Cash in here for you. You're listening to We the People.
.us.
I hear the train a-coming. It's rolling around a bend. And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling on down to San Antone.
Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
All right. No further foolishness here. We are deep into the Varsity Blues, the scandal within the scandal. That's the name of the book. The author is John Wilson, and honestly, I was just asking our engineers in there. I'm like, did you guys know any of this? Yeah, no. We all missed it, John. We feel guilty and ashamed. We completely missed what happened to your family, and I'm really glad you're telling the story. So there's a little blurb in here from your, I'm sure it's from your publicist, probably. It says, John Wilson tells the shocking and untold story backed by staggering evidence of how he became collateral damage by overreaching federal prosecutors who weaponized our justice system to satisfy bringing Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin, who were the two people we heard about all the time.
That's all you heard in the media.
To trial in Boston in the infamous Operation Varsity Blues case, and his ongoing battle against the federal government, Netflix, and USC to restore his family's honor. Honestly, they did a pretty good job of... I mean, did the media cover this at all, or were you just...
No. Unfortunately, the way the government can control the process, once you're charged and you're under trial and you're going through the process, you're not allowed to speak to the media. The judges say you're not going to try this in the court of public opinion. So the prosecutors can get out there and say what they want. And so every time someone was arrested or if someone was pleading guilty or someone was sentenced or someone went to prison, they got their bullhorn out and started broadcasting it across the media. We couldn't say anything. We're not allowed to say anything by the judge. So for 5 years, we had to remain silent while they're just smearing us over and over again. And, like anything, once the headline is out, 5 years later, it's kind of an afterthought. Who's going to, want to correct something? I'll give another example. Even in day one, in this case, when we were arrested, the Boston Globe had a front page cover story on this case, of course, and I was featured. I was a local man. I was featured, and they said I was already convicted of a previous felony for securities fraud or commodities trading fraud, something like that. I said, what? This is crazy.
Wow.
And they had the wrong John Wilson, right? They had a different John Wilson. They didn't even do their fact-checking, and they were trying to rush this story out. And so I'm smeared on the front page of the Boston Globe with not only being charged falsely in this case, but then falsely accused of being a felon for some other charges from years before. And so we said, this is the wrong thing. So, of course, they research it, and whatever, a week or two later, they put a correction on page, 32 as a footnote. Oh, yeah, by the way, John Wilson wasn't really convicted of something else. That was a mistake. And that's the way this whole process could work. They get the headlines month after month after month while this is all hot, and you're not allowed to say anything. And so, 6 years later, I'm trying to correct the record for my children. My career has been destroyed, but they still have 50 years of work ahead of them and a life ahead of them, and I want to do what I can. I think about my poor daughters for a second. They were 16 years old when this happened. 16 years old. Teenage girls. You know how vulnerable they are already to the normal social media pressures, right? Imagine having federal prosecutors say you're cheaters and you're basically accusing you of cheating, and being unqualified. And you get a perfect score, a near-perfect score. They're going to top, top schools, high schools, and highly qualified in every way. One of my daughters was captain of the water polo team at her school, and they were both swimmers, and they did all kinds of sports, basketball and volleyball and so forth. And so they're highly qualified, highly active, really smart, and they're being smeared, not by a bully from the school or some kind of, you know, rogue internet troll, but by federal prosecutors. Right? And you're 16. How do you deal with that, right? It's been devastating and traumatizing for them. And my son wasn't, you know, much better off. He was 21. You know, 21-year-old man, who spent 10 years competing nationally and internationally in sports, was a high-caliber athlete, had a world record when he was younger, and played on the USC team, now being called an alleged athlete. That's what the government still calls him to this day, an alleged athlete.
Wow.
They might as well be alleged human beings, right? Yeah. Alleged athletes. They know the truth, and they still smeared my children that way, and it's just despicable. So I'm fighting to get the record corrected for them, you know, more than myself, but it's been devastating. I not only have to spend $11 million in legal fees, which is an enormous amount. I had to deplete all my life savings. I was successful, but I had to spend every penny. I've lost my job for 7 years at the peak of my career, because once you're charged with these felonies, and even if with the remaining tax conviction, you can't get a job in a corporate America role.
Yeah, nobody wants you running their company while you're wearing a jumpsuit.
Right, or even if you're just accused and
you've been fitted for one.
Yeah.
Right, just the accusation alone is enough to scare people because, again, the government's conviction rate is 99.6%.
Yeah, so why would they bring a case if you didn't do it, right?
Well, that's how most people think as well. They must have something or they wouldn't prosecute him.
Exactly. No one thinks there's nefarious motivations. I think people are getting more sensitive to that now when they see how prosecutors can weaponize the justice against somebody like the president for political reasons or other people. So they're seeing how the weaponization of justice can be a reality. And it's not just political reasons, but there are other people like myself for career reasons. There may be vendettas. There may be other reasons. But I'm convinced that there's a lot of innocent people out there who didn't have the resources. And so as painful and as horrific as this has been, I'm actually still feeling somewhat blessed. I had the resources to fight. I had the willpower and the grit from my tough upbringing to fight. And I had the support of family and friends and our faith to fight. Most people don't have any of those three things. So I'm blessed in a lot of ways, even though this has been painful. I was able to fight. Most people can't. And they just get railroaded and they're sitting in prison and sometimes for years and years for a crime they didn't commit.
Yeah, that's the scary part. You know, when your justice system, you know, weaponizes the process against people, you do have a lot of innocent people that are behind bars because they couldn't defend themselves against the machine, you know, I'm hoping that's getting turned around now. I mean, we're hearing stories now of a lot of these folks, going out the door, but stories like yours need to really be told so people know the extent of what went on in our justice system. It's crazy.
It is. You step back and say, okay, what some of these other parents did was wrong. Cheating on tests is absolutely wrong. Is it a federal felony that deserves prison time?
Yeah.
I don't think so, personally. Putting a fake profile, putting a picture of your kid sitting on a rowing machine and photoshopping that like other parents did. I didn't do that. That's wrong. Is that a federal felony?
Yeah, you know, probably not.
Those kind of things are crazy. Yeah, but that's what they charge. Everyone had a felony charge. They said we're not going to lower anybody's charges below felony if you plead guilty. So everyone in this case had to plead guilty to a felony. And the Boston prosecutors look at it as just more scalps on a belt that could boost their careers. Mm. And that's the despicable part of this, right? It's so disproportionate to anything that's realistic. When you think about, like you said, some people who might be murdering and doing other bad acts, getting far less. But, you know, cheating on a test is now a federal felony. It's kind of crazy how disproportionate things are.
So this all, you know, this kicks off, right? They put you in prison and scare you, and then how long until you eventually are heard in court?
It takes about 2 years, once in 2021.
So it just hangs over your head for 2 years?
For 2 years, and they keep piling on charges in the meantime. So literally every 3 months they pile on another charge to try to pressure me to plead guilty. They charged me far more than anyone else, right? They kept piling on charge after charge for me because they wanted me to plead guilty because I had facts that proved I was innocent, right? So they didn't want to make me to go to trial at all. But they got a judge who blocked all my facts, so that was really the terrible thing that happened in my case. But they didn't want me to go to trial, so they kept piling on more charges. The average parent got one or two charges. I got nine. I was lucky, right? Nine charges they piled on me to pressure me to plead guilty. You know, no one else had, even the ringleader, Rick Singer, only had three felonies. So they just kept piling on and piling on. I'll tell you, the other thing was just another shocking little side story. And the book has about 50 shocking stories in it. Again, I would encourage your audience to read it. You know, Varsity Blues, The Scandal Within the Scandal. All the proceeds go to charity, not to me, but I want our story out there to correct the record. But the first day I'm in Boston for court, right? We're in court to plead guilty, enter our plea agreement. And there's 50 people that are there, right? You have all these parents. Felicity Huffman's there, Lori Loughlin's there. Everybody flies in from California. We're the local people. We just drove down from our house in the suburbs. So we're all there. The media throngs are crazy, right? This is a sensationalized story. And, you know, people are shoving microphones and cameras in your faces. It's horrible walking through that gauntlet of the media outside the courthouse. So we get in and we all plead not guilty. But everybody else has to go home. They have to catch a flight. They're all flying back to California. My wife and I said, look, we're going to sit back, let the media die down because we're just driving home. We can drive an hour later. Doesn't really matter. So we just decide to stay. We told our lawyer to leave. You know, we don't want to pay you very expensive rates, an hour to babysit us while we wait for the media to die down. So we go home. We'll stay by ourselves. We stay by ourselves. Everybody's gone. The media's still there, but it's about half what it was. We say, okay, let's go home now. It's like 4 o'clock. Let's drive home now. My wife decides to go to the restroom, and we're in the hallway of the courthouse on the ground floor waiting. They're just outside the entrance there. And as I'm waiting for her, the prosecutor, the lead prosecutor, comes up to me. But he approaches her talking. He says, hey, you know, if you plead now, I can get you a deal that'll exclude from the, whatever the rating factors, whatever he called it, the money you committed but didn't donate yet. And so we'll get you a lesser prison sentence. I said, what? I said, what are you talking about? I said, I'm not going to plead guilty. I didn't do anything wrong. And then I said to him, and besides, isn't it against the rules for you to be talking to me without my lawyer here?
Right. I even learned that on Law and Order.
My wife walks up. My wife starts walking up from the bathroom, and he sees her and gets a little panicked. I said it to him, and you know what his response was? It was a smug response that just still makes my blood boil to this day. He smirks at me and says, who do you think makes up the rules? Right? Think about the arrogance of that. Say that in a federal courthouse. Who do you think makes up the rules? Who do you think makes the rules for every shit like that? Like, what? I told my lawyer that happened that night, right? I said, he said, look, you can't do anything about it. It'd be your word against his. And by the way, you know, you're an accused felon and he's a federal prosecutor, so they're not going to believe you. So that's just the way they can do things. I said, really? That's our system? And that was just the lead off within Boston. That was my first experience with the Boston prosecutors. This is when I came back from Texas. And that's how they just kick off this whole process, right? They are smug and arrogant. And who do you think makes the rules? Really? That's how the system of justice is being run? They can make up the rules and break them, you know, whatever they want as it suits their needs. And they did that over and over and over in this process, blocking evidence, destroying evidence. They admitted on the stand they let Singer destroy thousands and thousands of his texts to people. Crazy stuff like that, right? And, you know, the stuff they did on evidence, hiding evidence, blocking evidence, was atrocious. But the judge approved it all, and the judge kept saying to us in the trial, take it up on appeal. I'll never forget, we were giving all of our evidence, trying to give our evidence. He blocked it 660 times. At the end, towards the end of the trial, the judge said, how much more evidence do you have? And we were entering things into what's called an offer of proof, because we knew we were going to lose. We had to put it into the trial record so that we could bring it to the appeals court. He said, how much more do you have? He said, like another 60 pieces, what the lawyer said. He said, well, I'm going to dismiss it all en masse. En masse? What do you mean on that? You don't even know what it is. Doesn't matter. I'm dismissing it all en masse. It's like a railroad. It was like a Russian show trial. I'm dismissing the rest of your evidence en masse. Oh, great. Thanks. You know, he kept saying, take it up on appeal. It's like, how is this a fair process?
Was your attorney surprised at this, or was
he
like...
They were flabbergasted.
Oh, okay.
It was just unbelievable. Right. They were totally shocked because you can't do anything about it. Once you're in the courtroom, the judge is the supreme authority. You can't do anything. And so you have to lose and then go to the appeals court. That's all you can do, and spend another $1 million on an appeal or $2 million on your appeal. Right? That's the process. Mm. The judge is the ultimate authority, and once you get a judge who's basically doing the bidding of the prosecutor, you know, he approves their motions 98.3%. You basically have nothing to do. You can't do anything to defend yourself. He blocks all your evidence. He lets other people in. So they let other people in who had nothing to do with us. So I had parents on the stand talking about, oh, everybody knew Singer was, you know, bribing coaches. I didn't know. How do you know me? I don't know Mr. Wilson, but, you know, I knew of him or whatever. I was in his town. One guy says, I was in Mr. Wilson's house once for a fundraiser. Okay, yeah. Did you ever talk to Mr. Wilson? No. So then the jury hears, oh, he knows Mr. Wilson. He's in my house. Well, yeah, he's in my house for a fundraiser with 50 other people or 100 other people. Okay. But I never talked to him. I don't know this guy. So they act like we were best friends. And, you know, everybody knew. Everybody didn't know. You might have known, but you can't speak for me. You know, and by the way, did Steve Jobs know? We couldn't bring other clients in of Singers, you know. So they can just smear you like that. And the dirty tactics at the trial, the dirty tactics in the courtroom, the dirty tactics in the motions were just horrific. I'll give you another example. It's just, and this will make some of your audience members probably blood boil too. They took all of my emails from like 10 years, not just the Singer emails. They violated the search warrant. They took all of our private family emails. So I had pictures of my children from family vacations. My daughter's at 12 years old wearing bikinis. And they shared that with 150 lawyers. And we tried to get the judge to pull that down from the website that was being shared, but they said, nope, got to keep it out there. That's what you get for being accused of this crime. You have to have all your stuff like that. My kids' medical records, there's no HIPAA law protection once you're accused. So HIPAA law goes out the window. Your medical records, all your medical records are exposed to all these lawyers involved in this case. Your children, imagine my twin daughters. My wife said, this is so creepy. Who knows if one of these guys is a pedophile, right? So my twin daughters, 12 years old, wearing bikinis, is being shared with 150 lawyers. Really? That's necessary as part of this trial? And we appealed to the judge. We begged the judge to take it down. He said, absolutely not. You know, that's got to remain out there. It's like, what? That's how vicious this process can be. Mm-hmm. And my wife was just sick to her stomach thinking about, you know, is there a pedophile looking at this stuff? My son was also in swimsuits as well. You know, who knows? It could be a male pedophile, too, for men. But, you know, having your teenage kids in swimsuits from private family photos and our own emails back and forth.
That had nothing to do with, I mean, the value of that in this particular case was zero, obviously.
Oh, just to destroy you emotionally and otherwise, right? And just to put more pressure on you.
Mm. Damn.
They would do that over and over and over throughout this process, right? Every time they had a chance, they would just try to stick it to you. And I also took polygraph tests. I volunteered. I took polygraph tests with the head of the FBI polygraph division, the former head, and separately quality controlled by the head of the CIA polygraph division, who ran the polygraph school for 10 years for the entire federal government. The real deal. You don't get any higher than these guys. The world's best polygraph experts. I took 2 days of polygraph tests, more than they've ever done for anyone in their history. So I never had a guy take 22 questions or whatever. I took 22 questions every aspect of this case. I passed them all with flying colors because I wanted to prove my innocence. I did this because we had 2 years before the trial. I said, what if I die of a heart attack with all the stress? I said, I want the truth to be recorded. So I volunteered, took these polygraph tests. Yeah, I took these polygraph tests. Now this time I'm 61 now waiting for this thing. And I passed them all. We actually submitted those, gave those to Netflix before the movie came out and said, look, we know you're doing a movie. We don't know who's going to be in it, but in case Mr. Wilson's in it, we gave them a 550-page letter that had all of our facts that were in the public record, including some of the stuff that wasn't, like these polygraph results. And we gave it to Netflix before the movie came out. They ignored it all and said, thank you, but we're going ahead with our movie. So the government had the polygraph test. So they knew I passed all these polygraph tests. And they use polygraphs all the time.
Sure.
But at a trial?
But they would only use it if it was bad. John, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, let's delve into this Netflix thing because, you know, people watch those and they think, I don't know what they think, but a lot of times people assume, well, you know, if it wasn't true, they wouldn't have made the movie about it.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. Our guest is John Wilson. He is the author of Varsity Blues, The Scandal Within the Scandal. You should definitely get the book. You can find this interview later at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
I'm gonna do bad things, do it like it's nothing. Being bad has never felt so good. I'm gonna do bad things,
doing bad things to you.
But the good news is there's angels everywhere out on the street, holding out a hand to pull you back up on your feet. The ones that you've been dragging for so long, you're on your knees, you might as well be praying. Guess what I'm saying, if you're going through hell, keep on going, don't slow down. If you're scared, don't show it, you might get out, or the devil even knows you're there.
And that's a true story. John, so what happened with Netflix?
Well, Netflix was also culpable here. So they announced before my trial, about 6 months before my trial, they're going to release a documentary called Operation Varsity Blues or something like that. And so we were worried that they would include me in that. And so we sent them a warning letter. We said, in case you're including Mr. Wilson in your documentary, here are all the facts. We sent them real photos of my son. And you can see all this on a website as well. There's a website we have called thescandalwithinthescandal.com. But in the Netflix, you know, warning letter, we included all the government and public filings because our facts were very different. We were charged with the same thing, honest services fraud, but all the other allegations for the other parents were very different. The other parents were alleged to have cheated. We were never alleged to have cheated. The other parents were alleged to have created fake profiles for kids who didn't even play the sport. We didn't do that. The other parents were alleged to have bribed coaches. We didn't bribe a coach. Our money went to the school. So our allegations were very, very different. And what you show in a movie is not the charges, but the allegations. They depicted me as a parent who was photoshopping their kid in the pool. They had a guy photoshopping a kid standing in the shallow end of the pool, a small little wimpy kid. Nothing against that kid, but they had a little tiny kid, you know, what I used to call a piped arm kid. My son was the real deal, standing in the shallow pool with a water polo ball above his head. And at the beginning of the movie, they show that kid's face being photoshopped when my voice is going on, right? So they use my voice, and the way they can, you know, make movies is horrible. You can put my voice in a conversation with a singer that's recorded, so it's my actual words, but it's being shown or it's being aired when they're depicting some guy photoshopping a kid's head. We never photoshopped anything, right? So they can do that. Well, we just use your voice. Well, yeah, it's my voice, but I didn't do that, what you have shown there, right? So they did a lot of stuff like that. So we filed suit because they smeared me. We did some focus groups, you know, on the Netflix movie later and at the time. Later, we did a focus group, and everybody who watched the movie, who never seen it, didn't know me before, concluded I was the worst parent of any because they showed me or had my words, I think, 23 times in the first 20 minutes or so.
Oh, my God.
Right? So they had me as the guy they show again and again and again and again. So they think, by inference, I did all the bad things. They had other people cheating and bribing and faking. And my name and my voice is coming up again and again. So you think I did it all. And I didn't do any of it, right? But that's what people came away thinking.
And the point of that for them was, like, I get the prosecutors wanted notoriety and all that. Netflix was just getting views. I mean,
they were just leveraging the audience, the built-in audience, but they wanted to maximize dollars and eyeballs because this was a sensational case. And I had more audio and more calls with Singer than anybody, so they had like 11 phone calls for me. Again, I didn't say anything illegal in those phone calls, but they could take a soundbite out of context. I'll give you two or three things they did in addition to like these photoshopping things. I had a conversation with Singer, and he says to me towards the end, one of the very last conversations, Don't meet with the schools, with the development office of the schools when you go out to Harvard or Stanford. I say, okay, well, why not? They don't play that second half. I say, okay, and they just stop it there. I say, okay, why not? He says, because then they'll hit you up for more donations. Right? That's what he says. So they don't play the second half. They say, just the finger half, saying, don't go to the schools. When you go to the schools, you know, with your daughters, don't meet with the development offices. I say, okay. And that makes it like I've got some kind of nefarious intent here. And I asked why not, and he says, because they'll hit you up for more donations. That's why you donated to his company in the first place, his foundation. So that kind of thing. Another example of what they did in the movie, which is just nefarious, is I'm trying to clarify how the money that I'm going to wire to him should go. And so I say to him, so I wired the money to you, not to the schools, right? And he says, yeah. And they end it there. Then they go to another parent talking about bribing coaches, right? And that's so misleading, it's crazy. Because then, very next thing on my mouth, then I say to him, and then you wired the money to the schools. right? All he's trying to figure out, do I wire the money to the schools directly or do I wire it to you and then you wire it to the schools? Well, they drop the second half of that conversation again, take the soundbite out of context, and then they juxtapose it with another parent saying we're going to bribe the coaches. So all they hear from me is, I don't wire the money to you. I don't wire the money to the schools. I wire it to you. And then somebody else says, well, we'll bribe the coach with that money. And so it misleads you to think that that's what I'm doing too.
Holy cow.
And they do it over and over. So this is the thing that will just blow your mind, maybe. It blew my mind. It's probably the worst part of this whole case, worse than being in the prison. So we did this focus group before the trial, and we had about 30 people from Boston in this big facility designed to do this kind of thing. It's a big, like, open seating area with some presentations, and people can be, like, mock attorneys. And we're sitting behind a two-way mirror just watching and listening. And I'll never forget, they started talking about the parents in this case. They started talking about me and other parents in this case. And one of the gentlemen who had a child who, I guess, didn't get into the colleges that they wanted, and I understand he's upset, and he said, you know what? These guys had all seen, or most of them had seen the Netflix movie. You know, I think these parents are worse than Hitler. Worse than Hitler, he said. Because
so is
they
Hitler.
Murdered, well, he said they murdered every child in America's dreams for college, including my daughter, right? What?
Wow.
So now here's a guy calling me worse than Hitler because he's seen the Netflix movie because I had murdered every child's dreams for college. It's like, what is going on here? Because, again, I think people, and we're justifiably upset. If I had a child who didn't get into their school and Felicity Huffman or somebody else had a child that was not qualified, that made a bribe and did some other false statements in their, you know, applications, and they bumped my more qualified kid, I'd be mad too. Yeah, would I call the person Hitler? Probably not. But I understand the anger and the frustration. But imagine sitting behind a two-way mirror and having people talk about you in a focus group and say you're worse than Hitler because you murdered every child in America's dreams for college.
Jeez.
This is how crazy this case is getting, right?
Okay, were you just like, okay, I'm going to prison? Like that? I mean, that had to be like a super depressing day.
Oh, it was incredibly depressing. It's like, my God, how do you get out of that hole?
Yeah, right?
And then on top of it, you have a trial where the judge blocks all your evidence. Right? It's just because they cherry-pick the judge. They hand-pick through judge shopping. And that's another process which is crazy. So what they can do is every judge gets assigned randomly, right? And that's good. Should be assigned randomly. I get that. That's great. But what they could do is they could sprinkle some cases. In the case of Boston, they had, let's say, a bunch of low-level cases. So the administrator worked for Singer, some coach over here, a test taker over there. They sprinkled a bunch of cases, and they all got assigned randomly to different judges. And then, I think there were only six or seven judges, federal judges in Boston. Then when they got the judge they wanted, they stopped. So they had, let's say, five different judges and cases assigned randomly. They covered the whole gamut. And then they amended that judge's docket, the judge that they wanted, and said, now we're going to make it one national conspiracy, and we're going to charge all these people as one part of one national conspiracy, and we're going to add it to this judge's docket. And so they can basically circumvent the random assignment process through that kind of judge shopping. Right? And then they got the judge they wanted, who ruled against us, et cetera, and made this the trial kind of a farcical trial. That it's very rare to ever get an appeals court to overturn all your core convictions, right? They did that, and then they dropped all those charges because they knew that if I had a new random judge, there's no way they would have gotten away with all the stuff they did, you know, at that trial. So, you know, the process is so fundamentally flawed. We shared all this with Netflix. We even shared with the prosecutors. They got a copy of all my polygraph results that we gave to Netflix. But Netflix ignored it, and so did the prosecutor. In fact, at my first sentencing, when I was found guilty of everything before my appeal, they wanted me to get 14 months of prison time, more than anybody else. They said I was the worst parent by far. That's what they kept telling the judge and everybody. Mr. Wilson's the worst parent by far in this case. Right? They were just, that's why they piled on nine felonies.
Were you considered like a ringleader? I mean, was this like you guys all worked together? Or
no, just because I had three children. Other people had five children involved and so forth, right? But they were just trying to characterize me as being the most evil guy because they said, why are you piling on nine felonies against this guy?
Yeah.
I must have got one or two, right? So they had to make some story up. Their narrative was, I was the worst parent by far. Even though my kids got a perfect score, my son played on the team, my money went to the school. They knew all this. Money went to the school. They knew all this stuff, but they still had the character of being the worst parent. And, you know, at my sentencing, they said, well, we could admit the polygraph there. And they said, and the judge said, I'm not going to read it because it's self-serving, they said. The polygraph itself.
Oh, God.
It's self-serving. Okay, it was self-serving. It's kind of crazy.
It's called a trial. Basically. Yeah.
Yeah, it's self-serving, the polygraph test. So that's the kind of process they can run you. I never took a polygraph in my life. I did it just because I wanted the truth to be there. And as I mentioned earlier, in case I died of a heart attack or something happened to me between, you know, when I was arrested and the trial. So I volunteered to take it. And, you know, none of that seemed to matter. The truth didn't matter to these guys. It was more about getting a conviction. Once they charge you, and they falsely accused me, they knew they had to try to cover that up by either getting me to plead guilty or railroad me through a trial and get me convicted. Because that would then, you know, make their actions look legitimate. And so they had to win a trial. They just railroaded me through a trial that was just outrageous in every way possible. And then they fought on the appeal as well. And I'll never forget on the appeal side, we finally had three judges who were very capable asking good questions. And they asked the prosecutors, this is a different person now, this is the appeals person, you know, what evidence did you have that Mr. Wilson did anything wrong here, right? And it was outrageous. This was caught in the media. The media was there, too. It's all, there's overwhelming evidence. There's, you know, all these parents were bribing coaches, cheating on tests. You know, the judge said, no. What evidence you have that Mr. Wilson did something wrong? What specific, you know, examples or facts?
Because this is your appeal, and you're the only defendant, right?
Right, and they were just smearing me with the bad acts of other people.
Yeah, okay.
Again, right? That's the whole thing they did. Right, so it's just guilt by association. So no, what did Mr. Wilson do? And they said, oh, we have overwhelming evidence about Mr. Wilson, too. And the judge, for a third time, the judge, three times, just says, well, what specific examples can you give me that Wilson, that you have hard evidence that Mr. Wilson did something wrong? And you know what they said? It was crazy. They said, well, Mr. Wilson edited his son's essay, and that's not allowed, and he's the one who submitted the photos of his son, turned them part of their fake photos. And those two things are not allowed. Those are felonies because on the form, the college application, it says you did all this work yourself. You had no help from anybody else. And so the judge said, wait, don't most parents help their kids edit their essays? Yeah, but that's illegal. Like, what? So that was my crime, they said. That was the hard evidence they had, that I helped edit my son's essay. And I uploaded the photos because I had the photos on my camera. My son doesn't have photos of himself on his own iPhone. So I had photos of him in water polo in the pool. So I uploaded the photos directly to whatever website, whatever the thing was. Okay, so put me in jail, I guess. I uploaded the photos. So that's and the judge said, what? Don't most parents do that? And so in the end, when they're forced to tell the truth to a judge who is reasonable, asking hard questions, the evidence they had was I edited my son's essay, and I uploaded the photos. And they're supposed to be all done by my son. I didn't know that you signed some kind of statement at the bottom
who
of your application that?
That
you just... Who reads this stuff? And so, you know, and even so, I think most people still help, and they get some of their high school counselors to help. They get all kinds of people to help and do stuff. So it's just kind of outrageous when the prosecutors had to say something that was truthful to these, you know, appellate judges. They had nothing.
Wow. Mm.
And so the appellate judges threw it out?
They threw it out. They overturned all the convictions. All the forfeits, except for one, which is the tax thing. Because on the tax thing, I did put it on the wrong line. They said, oh, Mr. Wilson's guilty on the tax thing. He deducted it on this line, and it shouldn't have been deductible at all because it was all a bribe. Wait a minute, the bribe was overturned, but under the tax law, you're not allowed to take a deduction if you've got a benefit. And our guy said, well, the benefit is hard to quantify. It's not like you go to a dinner and you pay $1,000 for a fundraising dinner and you get a $50 steak meal and they deduct $50. And give you a donation receipt for $950. They gave him the receipt for whatever it was, $100,000 at USC, and I deducted that. And they said you weren't allowed to deduct that. And the judges said, well, you put it on the wrong line at a minimum, so that is a felony. It's actually a fraud. If you put something on the wrong line in your tax return, you impede the IRS's ability to analyze your taxes. That's the quote I got. Okay, I didn't even read it. My taxes, by the way, I was living in Europe, working in Europe. I was paying taxes in Europe, I was paying taxes in the Netherlands, I was paying taxes in the U.S., and in California. My tax returns were over 250 pages long. I didn't read them. Maybe I should, that's bad, but, you know, I was a busy executive. I didn't read them, I just signed them through DocuSign. And it didn't matter, because once you sign them, you're responsible for everything in it. So if you put something on the wrong line,
yeah,
that can be a felony.
Okay, that's...
And they got me for that.
That's...
And I'm still fighting that piece.
Completely mental. We have to take one last break, and then when we come back, let's talk about USC, because they're involved in this as well, and so let's make sense of that a little bit. Okay, none of this makes any sense, though, John. Our guest is John Wilson. He is the author of Varsity Blues, The Scandal Within the Scandal. And just in case you already thought you knew what happened with this college admissions thing, yeah, by the way, you didn't. So we will be right back. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
We don't need no thought control. No dark sarcasm in the classroom. Teacher, leave them kids alone.
Best lead in for USC that I had. That's all I had. I didn't have Tusk. Sorry.
There you go.
So, how did they fit into this whole thing?
Well, USC, I think, is probably the most culpable in this whole process. We sued Netflix for defaming us, defamation, right. And we sued USC for defrauding us. Because, shockingly, we did our homework and we did our due diligence. When we were first donating, this is back in 2014, for my son, we didn't just donate to USC blindly through Singer. We actually went and did our due diligence. We met with the school. So my wife, my son, and I, we went down to USC before we made our donations to verify that donating through Singer's organization was fine. We met with the coach, the head coach. We also met with the development officer for athletics at USC. So we met with two different independent people to verify donating through Singer was fine. They said, yes, we've done this many times in the past. You make a donation, and that'll get you into the subco process, their subcommittee for admissions for athletes. And if you make a donation or a commitment for a donation, we'll review you through the subco. And subco has a much higher probability of admissions than the normal admissions process. We said, okay, great. And it's okay to donate through Singer's foundation? They said, yeah, we've done that in the past. Okay, no problem. So we verified that, and we verified with my son, he was there, with the coach, his credentials. So the coach asked him all kinds of questions about who his coaches were in high school, and he played for Stanford Club for 6 years, he said. Stanford Club is one of the top water polo teams in the country. That's well known. He was a starter there for years. He's one of the fastest players. He was always what they call the sprint-off player. So we went through all of this stuff with the USC people, and then after my son was accepted, we made our donation. They told us to make a donation after he was accepted. And then my son, we brought him to the water polo dorm or the water polo apartment. They had apartments for the water polo team. There was eight person apartment suites, four bedrooms with, two beds in each bedroom for the water polo kids who were the young red shirts. We brought off that dorm, went to practices. We went throughout the entire season, went to games and everything else to watch my son. And so we did everything according to what the USC people told us. And then at my trial, the US people said, no, none of that was legal. This is all a bribe. I said, what? Yeah, you cannot get a boost in admissions for a donation. We said, that's not what you told us. So basically at the trial, if what they say is true, you have to accept what they say at the trial as being the truth, Then they lied to us and defrauded us back in 2014. They said this was completely legitimate in 14. And then in 2019 at my trial, or actually 2021 rather, the trial was in 2021, they said this is all abroad. This is not legal. I said, this is crazy. And so we learned of it then, and that's what we're saying to Netflix. That's what we're saying to USC. We filed suit in California. The judge has overruled us in the first hearing there. By the way, Netflix, we won their motion to dismiss. And we're going to trial. Now we're getting discovery. So that was good. We won in Superior Court in Massachusetts. In California, we lost the first round against USC. They're saying the statute of limitations should have started earlier. We say we didn't learn of this fraud until 2021. They're saying it should have happened when you were arrested in 2019.
How would you,
should have known what you did was illegal. I said, we didn't know it was illegal. We didn't think we... They said, you were on notice then because you were arrested for some reason. I said, yeah, I was arrested because they used me as a geographic pawn, not because I did anything wrong. But the judge, at least in the first phase of this, said, you must have known what you did was wrong. I said, no, I didn't. But we're appealing that one now. We're fighting that one through the appeals process. Again, more money, more time, and more resources than we have. Now, thank God that the work in case of both cases is being done on a contingent basis in large part. So don't spend much in the legal costs, you know, moderate amounts now. But, you know, fighting against three Goliaths at once is extremely frustrating and challenging in so many ways. It's not only a financial drain, but it's an emotional drain. And they keep doing this. And USC still smears us. Your son wasn't qualified. You know, there's one bad email that I have from 2014. I was worried about my son sitting in on the team when Singer says, I said to my son, you know, is he going to get any playing time? He says, no. USC, are you kidding? The only freshmen who get playing time are these monsters from Eastern Europe that Jovan, who's the Eastern European coach, he brings in all these ringers from Eastern Europe. That's how the team wins national championships. He brings in guys who are 25 years old as freshmen who haven't played, who've been playing water polo on club level, but haven't gone to college, and they qualify under NCAA rules if they haven't been to college yet to be a freshman. And I said, Jesus, how could my son, who's 17, hold the candle to these guys who are 25 from, you know, Serbia and, Hungary and Croatia, right? I say to him, is he going to be a leper? I said, is he going to be a leper? I was thinking about the post rate. I said, are they going to, like, how's my guy going to be able, you know, he's a 7-year-old kid and he's going to be 25-year-old military guys from Serbia. And how's he going to fit in? Is he going to be, like, put in a corner? Is he going to be, like, a leper? I said that. Is he going to be a leper? And they said, oh, that's proof you knew your son wasn't qualified. No, they take it out of context. That's proof I was worried about him versus 25-year-old men from Eastern Europe. But he was highly qualified against kids his own age. So that's when we went to the school, and as I told you, we did our due diligence. When we went to the school, met with the coach, we saw the team practicing, you know, 5 feet away from the pool's edge. We're standing by the pool's edge having our conversation. And we saw some of these older men, but we also saw some kids my son had played against in high school, you know, a year ahead of him. So we knew he could fit in just fine. It never came up again, but they go back to that email exchange from when my son was a junior in high school before we visited the team in person to say that was proof this was all fraud. They take things out of context like that. That was proof I was worried about my son fitting in socially with 25-year-old men from Eastern Europe. Yeah, but not that he wouldn't fit on the team as a player athletically against kids who are 19. So that's how they could run this whole process. And so we basically look at USC as being one of the most culpable because they defrauded us. They told us this was all how they did business. But we, in fact, had 100 examples of USC giving donor families a boost in admissions. But the judge disallowed all that evidence.
So yeah, because that had to happen a bunch of times. I mean, that's how they were doing it with everybody.
Yeah, exactly. It happened hundreds of times. We had examples of that. But the judge blocked all our evidence. Again, he blocked our evidence 660 times during the trial. And they said USC is not on trial here. It's the parents who are on trial. That's what the government kept saying. But USC was the one who was doing this all the time.
Yeah,
and
correct.
They were raising millions and millions of dollars.
And they get to keep all the money.
And they got to keep all the money, right. And they never gave it back, and they gave me a receipt for it. And then they said at my trial, this is all a bribe.
But they gave you a receipt.
But they gave me a receipt, and they never gave it back. I never heard
John,
be able
what
to
I'm,
a bribe
what I'm really
either.
Taking away from this is you're a terrible criminal. If you're,
yeah, they painted us out to be the worst of the worst.
You're just a terrible criminal. You're just bad at crime. It's a good thing that wasn't your life's ambition, because this... I mean, a lot of this?
Yeah, if we had criminal intent, why would we go to the school and bring the coaches and bring our son? Well, why would we go to games and practices? Yeah. We went to multiple games and practice.
And get receipts.
This wasn't a fraud.
Come on.
And we got a receipt for our donation, right? We wouldn't do any of this
write
stuff.
Checks. So, you wrote checks. Nobody writes checks if you're in crime, right? It's all crypto
right.
and whatever. What about these prosecutors?
Right.
Yeah, or cash. Yeah, cash is always good. Prosecutors, what, before we run out of time, did those people just get off scot-free? Are they still out there, you know, messing up other people's lives?
Oh, it's unbelievable. They gave themselves, there's about 20 prosecutors involved, 18 or 20 in the office. They gave themselves all these hero awards. It's unbelievable. They literally call themselves heroes. They gave this award they got from the Central DOJ office in D.C., commending them for their, you know, heroism and so forth. I mean, prosecuting this case, no one's above the law, all these platitudes. It's like, really? Yeah, maybe going after some of these parents for test cheating was a good thing to stop it, but to make that a felony and then to go after people like me and smear my innocent children, they gave those hero awards, and the top people have all left for million-dollar partner roles at these firms. Just like you think. That's what they do. They get a big national high-profile case. One of the guys who's in this thing had his own podcast talking about it. Said they had gotten like 2 million hits on Google. This case had gotten like 2 million hits on Google. They were on the cover of, I think, one of these like People magazine twice, and he's bragging about this stuff on his podcast, right? It's like, really? So the publicity is what these guys crave and gals crave, and it worked for them, right? It got them notoriety. And again, people did bad stuff. I'm not saying everybody should have gotten off scot-free.
Right.
There were people who were cheating on tests. People were bribing coaches. People were faking things left and right. And that's wrong. And should they be arrested? Probably, maybe not. I don't know. Should it have been a felony? Absolutely not, in my mind. But should it have been this big national moment? You know, probably not. They were leveraging the Me Too movement, the anti-1% movement, you know, things like that. They were all going on in some of the different things happening. So, you know, at its core, this is a lot of wealthy parents who are being accused of abusing their privilege to help their unqualified kids bump you and you and you, all the parents listening, your children from being admitted to colleges. And that's unfair and it's wrong, and we ought to hold these guys accountable and put them in prison. Right? And that was the kind of mindset that was going on. It was almost like you could see people with pitchforks and torches running through the villages looking for me because it was that kind of, you know, hysteria that was being whipped up. And that's what they leveraged throughout this process for their own careers, and they did it quite successfully. These guys are smart. I mean, I'm not saying they weren't smart and good, but they're certainly very unethical the way they, you know, certainly prosecuted me in this case.
Hmm. Wow.
So I gotta ask, how are your kids doing now?
They're still struggling. My poor daughters, you know, it's been devastating emotionally. You can imagine, you're 16 when you're being accused on a global scale by federal prosecutors of being unqualified. It's just devastating to your own psyche, your mental health and well-being, right? So it's been devastating.
Hmm.
And my son, too, right? Your whole life is spent in athletics. And the government calls you now a fake athlete. And so now your close friends know you, and that's good. They support you. But you go beyond your circle of friends, immediate knowledge, and the internet and the trolls just destroy you. So you look for a job now, and you Google his name, and it still comes up as he was a fake athlete and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, so it's just, it's going to follow them forever. And the prosecutors know that, and they relish that. And they relish the fact they can destroy people's lives. And even after you win, there's a famous, you know, case of a secretary called Donovan. Where do you go to get your reputation back?
Yeah, right. I was just going to say, and the retraction is on page, you know, 50.
Yeah, on the bottom of page 50 is a footnote when it's been headlines for years, you know, smearing you. So it's just the process is so despicable, and there's a lot of things that we're going to recommend that should be changed. And I'm going to do a second edition of the book. But we're working to do whatever we can to correct the record for our children and to help do what we can to make sure this doesn't happen to anybody else. Because if it can happen to me, it can happen to others.
Oh, sure.
And I'm sure it has happened to others, and I'm sure it will happen to others, but we want to do our fair share to make sure we can reduce that, because it's just wrong when our system can be abused this way.
Yeah. Well, that's not what people think that, you know, that's not what people think should be happening in our justice system.
And can you contact, or have you had any contact with the current administration, as the current DOJ, as far as writing what some of these prosecutors have done. Is there anything they can do for you?
Yeah, we're looking into that right now as we speak, actually. So that's one of the steps that we're taking as well, because we want to see changes in the system.
Sure.
You know, for example, there's some simple things. One thing that you may not know this, your audience may not know this, but no FBI interviews with any witnesses are ever recorded. It's a policy.
Wow.
And there was a big phone call made to us in this case that was made from the FBI's own offices by Rick Singer that was never recorded. It's like, what? So this is kind of a crazy policy. They only write down their notes, called 302 notes, after they've had a conversation, and they do it from memory. And so that way they can actually twist the truth to fit the narrative they want.
Sure.
So the whole process is a bit backwards. So we want to recommend, this has been recommended in the past, and the government has fought it tooth and nail, that every interaction with every witness should be recorded. Just like the, you know, some of the Rodney King and other events forced changes in the street cops to wear body cameras.
Sure.
The equivalent for the FBI and prosecutors is every interview ought to be recorded. They had to press the record button on their phone, right? It's easy to do. They had devices everywhere all the time. Every interview ought to be recorded. That would stop a lot of stuff they did. They said in my case, for example, they never recorded or wrote down anything that was exculpatory. It's like, what? You can't do that. That's not allowed in the rules. That's what they said. If we didn't write down anything that was exculpatory. So, for example, there was a one-hour call or a 34-minute call. It was extremely helpful. They didn't record it. And all they had with their notes was seven words. Good first call with Wilson Daughters. That's what they write, right? So they hide all the evidence that way. It's like, really?
I'm surprised.
So we're going to recommend things like requiring all these things to be recorded. Now, in the past, I guess Robert Mueller is the one who opposed this vehemently, whatever it was, 15 years ago, that there was a recommendation to record, and he said, no, it would impede the FBI's ability to investigate and blah, 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 blah.
Oh, my God.
Impede, just hold them accountable.
John, we are doomed by the clock. The clock has us.
Okay.
But we're going to do this again because this was really interesting.
We put your book on our website, Varsity Blues, The Scandal Within the Scandal.
At We the People Radio.
.us.
Well, it's been nice chatting with you. Thank you.
Thanks.
You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay. We got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down. We can't hold back like you know. We wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.